line, and that made it nearly sacred. But recognizing how hard Joe was working, I gave in and sent it up to Oak Ridge via Federal Express. When Cheryl Takach, Joe's assistant, called to let me know the book had made it, I was tremendously relieved. Joe called soon afterwards and asked if I had really been able to understand the math and science in the book. My response was yes, but it took a lot of determination, time, and study. It was clear the book was also going to play a part in the next script revision. But in what way? Mostly I was afraid that it would make us look too smart. I was savvy enough to know that Hollywood, especially in the Spielberg era, loved kids to be smarter than their parents. Although we rocket boys had the mental tools needed to build rockets, we certainly weren't any more intelligent than our folks, and I didn't want us to come off that way. Then Tom Spain called with news. "Please keep this to yourself," he said. "But Rocket Boys has been nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award." Since I didn't know what that was, Tom explained, "It's big, Homer, really big. It's like getting an Oscar. Just getting nominated is a huge honor." I hung up, feeling pleased and validated. But it didn't take long before I started worrying about the movie again, after I read in a magazine article that Rocket Boys was going to be a low-budget film. To me, this meant cheap. Looking for clarification, I called Mickey, but he was in New York, so I called Chuck Gordon's office. Peter Kramer answered. After I read the pertinent parts of the article to him, he explained that a film's budget was whatever the purchasing studio said it was, and though he wasn't sure the article was correct, he guessed the amount they'd quoted of around $28 million was about right. "Chuck is going all out for this movie," he added, "and he'll fight to see every dollar shows up on the screen. Don't worry." After I hung up, I pondered what Peter had said and concluded he was right. If Chuck Gordon couldn't make a good film, nobody could. On the other hand, I'd kind of gotten used to worrying about both the book and the movie, so I kept my options open. With great anticipation, but not knowing really what to expect, Linda and I headed to Oak Ridge in early February to visit the sets being constructed. Oak Ridge was a town created in the 1940s to secretly develop the world's first atomic bomb. Since then, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory had provided major employment in the town for engineers and scientists. The work in the surrounding area, however, was mostly farming and coal mining. On our first evening in town, Joe invited us out to dinner. When we entered the restaurant and sat down with him, he made a silent signal, and to our surprise, everyone in the restaurant stood up and applauded. It turned out he'd reserved the restaurant entirely for us and the film crew. I stood and gave a little speech about how much I appreciated them and what they were about to do. When I sat down, Joe said, "Most of them are sure this is the most important movie they'll ever work on." When I looked doubtful, he added, "I don't think you understand how powerful and inspirational this story is to other people." He was correct about that. All I knew was I'd written a pretty good book that I hoped people would want to read. The next morning, Linda and I visited Rocket Boys Productions in a small Oak Ridge office building where I was surprised to find Joe's office walls covered with his own drawings of Colwood and coal miners. In an adjoining room, a model of the town was on display. I shot some video of everything and then listened as Joe played the haunting soundtrack from The Education of Little Tree by Mark Isham. "I'm pretty sure I'm going to use Mark to write our soundtrack," he said. He also said he'd set up a visit to a local coal mine and wondered if I would like to go. I said I would love it and asked if Linda could go too. "You're not afraid of going into a mine?" he asked her. "A lot of people have claustrophobia." "Linda's a scuba instructor," I pointed out. "She's not afraid of much." Joe shrugged and agreed Linda could go. For my part, I discovered I was eagerly looking forward to going underground again. I had not been inside a mine since my college days, when I'd worked to help pay my way through college. I would later write about that in Sky of Stone, telling another story of Colwood that included how I had finally found out why my dad loved coal mining so much. In fact, after being a coal miner for a while, I'd come to love it too. That didn't stop me from wanting to work for NASA, though. Joe went back to his work as we continued our self-guided tour, stopping to chat with Barry Robison, the production designer. Although we'd talked on the phone and faxed back and forth, it was the first time I'd actually met him. A slender and cheerful young man, Barry described his vision of the sets, which included a coal mine tipple, a machine shop, the superintendent's house, and a variety of exteriors. The sets were primarily in Petros, a small mining town a few miles from Oak Ridge, and Barry recommended that we drive over there to have a look. In Petros, we first visited the house that was being used for the interior of the Hickam family home. The owner was outside, watching the movie carpenters building him a new front porch as partial payment for the use of his house. When I introduced myself, he invited me inside. I was pleased to note the house had a lot of the same details as the actual Hickam house in Colwood, including polished oak floors, a big kitchen, and steps with a heavy banister leading upstairs to the bedrooms. When we came outside, one of the carpenters noticed the flight jacket I was wearing, which had Hickam on the name patch. "Are you related to Homer Hickam?" he asked. When I said I was actually the man himself, he frowned and said, "But we thought you were dead." Linda laughed. Our next stop was the tipple set. A tipple is used to sort the coal brought out of the mine, after which it is dumped into railroad cars. It was the tipple in Colwood that caused all those locomotives chuffing in and out of town every day, dragging behind them miles of coal cars. Since Petros had no tipple, Joe had solved that by buying one, disassembling it, trucking it to Petros, and erecting it there. He'd also added some superficial changes to give it the look he wanted. All in all, it was an impressive structure of wood and steel, and included an actual working elevator, what miners call a man lift, although the movie set version only dropped into a shaft about 25 feet deep. The next weekend, we went with Joe and his crew to visit the real coal mine. Accompanying us was Tom Taylor, who'd been hired to advise Joe on coal mining operations. On the way, Tom and I had a nice chat about coal mining in general, and I was impressed by his knowledge. Although he hadn't met my dad, he knew who he was and some of the advances Dad had made in the arcane science of mine ventilation. Throughout the making of the movie, Tom would prove to be a great asset for Joe in terms of making the mining scenes as realistic as possible. As a reward, Joe would put him in the film. In the opening scenes, while the radio announcer is talking about the launching of Sputnik, he can be seen sitting in a barber's chair with shaving cream on his face. Whenever I see it, it reminds me of what I looked like when I first talked to Joe Johnston. It also reminds me how glad I am that Tom was available to work on the movie. It would not have been as realistic without him. Our visit was to the Drift Mine near Petros. Drift mines go along an angled passageway into the side of a mountain rather than the vertical shaft as was used in Colwood. But it still reminded me of Dad's mine since it had a low roof and used big continuous miners and loaders, which hadn't changed much since the 1950s. Before we went inside, we were given a briefing by the company safety man, who listed the hazards of a coal mine, including how the roof could shift and fall, how coal exuded explosive methane, and how the tight quarters and darkness were a bad combination when it came to accidents. One of Joe's assistant directors, a tough-looking young woman I will call Teresa, was cracking jokes at the safety man. "Let's get down, Joe," she yelled. For his part, Joe was being a bit pensive. The safety man seemed to single Linda out for special attention.
"Don't be afraid, little lady,"
he drawled around his tobacco chaw as he checked her safety pack, helmet, and light.
"You just say the word and I'll bring you out."
"I think I'll be okay," Linda replied.
"There's rats at the face," the safety man said.
"Excuse me?"
"There's rats at the face. Biggins."
"Thank you," Linda said. "That's very interesting."
"Let's go dig some coal," Teresa yelled.
When we entered the mine aboard diesel-powered rubber-tired trams, I looked at the passing walls and roof, remembering the last time I'd ever been underground. My dad had taken me there to convince me his way of life was the one I should join, and now here I was, back in a coal mine, watching the gray walls blur by, the slate roof studded with roof bolts flashing overhead. It was all still so familiar. The script still had me quitting school and going to work in the mine to take care of the family after Dad got hurt, but that wasn't the way it was at all. The real story was, I went inside the mine because my dad wanted to convince me to be a mining engineer. When pressed, I had to tell him I wasn't going into mining but wanted to work in the space business, which was a lot harder than quitting school, at least for me. I peered out of the tram, and one of the miners watching us flashed his helmet lamp toward us, which made me think again of that day in the mine with my father. I had written about it this way. The beam from his helmet lamp was in my eyes. There's no men in the world like miners, Sonny. They're good men, strong men, the best there is. I think no matter what you do with your life, no matter where you go or who you know, you will never know such good and strong men. You're my boy, he said, and then turned so his lamp shined down a side cut, the lamps of his men flashing back from the darkness, as if they knew he was passing. I was born to lead men in the profession of mining coal. Maybe you were too. You're my boy. In the dark, I could savor the words without embarrassment. We stopped and climbed out of the trams. I warned Linda about bumping her head against the 5-foot-high roof and showed her the coal miner's walk taught me by my dad 40 years before. Bent over, hands behind my back, head up so my helmet lamp shined forward. She emulated my walk while I listened to the dull clunk of helmets against the unyielding roof, the sound of rookie miners forgetting they couldn't stand up straight. We also heard the roar of machinery. At a cut, a shuttle car trundled by carrying coal from the face, where the coal was cut away, to a conveyor belt. I took a deep breath, and there it was, like wet gunpowder, the smell of a coal mine. Joe came up alongside, and I pointed at a roof bolt and told him how it was used to hold the roof in place. I looked around and found a small pry bar and also showed him how tapping on the roof could tell an experienced miner its condition. A solid thunk meant it was strong, but a noise like rattling dishes meant a fragmented, dangerous roof.
Was that what happened when Mr. Bykovsky got killed? Joe asked.
That was a methane explosion, I replied, and then explained how the night of the accident the ventilation fans had gone down because of a thunderstorm, which had then led to a buildup of methane and an explosion. When the safety man walked up and urgently whispered in Joe's ear, he immediately walked away with him. Wondering what had happened, I followed. At the trams, I heard a woman crying. It was Teresa, the assistant director. Her face was in her hands, her shoulders shaking as she wept. I just can't do this, she said.
I'll take you out, ma'am,
the safety man said in a kind voice and climbed in, turned the tram around and headed for the surface. Linda, walking up, said, I guess she didn't want to see rats at the face. I guessed she didn't either, but I didn't take it as a sign of cowardice or anything else but what it was. Some people simply can't stand being underground. It's as if the mountain above mentally crushes them. Growing up in a coal town, I'd seen more than one strong man unable to withstand the trauma of working beneath a billion tons of rock. Linda and I caught up with the group at the face. We didn't see any rats, but we saw a continuous mining machine being operated by a miner named Squirrel. He showed me the controls, not much different from the ones I'd used when I'd worked in the mine nearly 40 years before, and I took over for a cut. Linda crept up to the front of the big machine, watching intently as I took a run at the layer of bituminous coal. I saw her look up, then edge back. When I joined her, she said, I remembered in your book where you said it wasn't safe to go under an unsupported roof. That's why I didn't get any closer. Smart girl, and she was absolutely right. A lot of good miners have forgotten that and lost their lives, but Linda had remembered. She was also having fun. Any woman who has fun in a coal mine has got to be a good woman. She later reported that it took several washings to get the coal out of her blonde hair. After we came out of the mine, Joe said,
Next week we start filming. Are you coming up?
After I said I would if he needed me, Larry took me aside and said it probably wasn't a good idea because the first week of filming was always prone to delays. That sounded reasonable. So I told Joe I'd come up in a couple of weeks because I had marketing work to do for Delacorte Press, which happened to be true. Before we left to drive back to Huntsville, Linda and I accepted an invitation to meet some of the actors in the movie. It was also a chance to see an old friend. Weeks earlier, Larry had asked me about the West Virginia dialect for his actors, and I'd suggested he hire Emily Sue Buckberry, the high school classmate who suggested I go looking for Sonny to tell the story, and who also happened to be a speech therapy professor at the University of Ohio. Happily, Larry took me up on the suggestion, so we headed over to an Oak Ridge hotel where Emily Sue was holding a dialect class for the four young actors playing the Rocket Boys. After Emily Sue and I exchanged hugs, Larry introduced the four young men. Chad Lindbergh, a tall youth with Jimmy Stewart looks, was playing Sherman Odell, a character that combined Odell Carroll and Sherman Sires. In the book, Odell is excitable and filled with energy, while Sherman, who had polio and a severe limp, was thoughtful and reserved. I thought it would be interesting to see how Chad would combine two such diametrically opposite characters into one. Will Lee Scott, playing Roy Lee Cook, was small in stature, but exuded toughness and maturity, which was perfect for the boy who loved the girls and did his level best to show me a pathway through the strange corridors of teenage love. Chris Owen was Quentin Wilson, the genius of our group, who also lived a desperate life of poverty he tried to keep hidden. With his shock of red hair and goofy expressions, Chris didn't look much like the real Quentin, who was sharp-nosed and had slick black hair, but I could see why he was cast. He had about him the air of the quintessential nerd. As for Billy Rose, the sixth Rocket Boy, his character had unfortunately been eliminated from the script. I hated that he wasn't going to be in the movie, but I understood why. For one thing, four actors were cheaper than six. For another, to develop six boys would require time, and time is always the enemy in any movie. I had never argued about this aspect of the script. As a writer, I fully understood why it had been done, although I felt bad for Billy. Last to be introduced was Jake Gyllenhaal, who was playing me, or at least the Hollywood version of Sonny / Homer. Jake was a handsome young man, 16 at the time and still in high school, with deep blue eyes, mine are brown, that twinkled with mischief. He vigorously shook my hand. "I hope I can do you justice," he said. "I think you'll be great," I replied, although I had no idea if he would or not. Jake frowned. "Man, I don't know. I'm terrible at math." "So was I when I was your age," I replied, which was the truth. I added, "We can talk more about things later." "That would be great," he said, while grinning a lopsided smile that I guessed every girl in the world would find cute. He seemed like a nice boy, and I was glad he'd gotten the part. I just hoped he was a good actor, too. On the drive home, I kept thinking about the actors playing the Rocket Boys. All came with solid acting credentials except Jake, who had little movie experience except for a couple of brief scenes as Billy Crystal's son in City Slickers and a small part in Homegrown, a low-budget film directed by his father, Stephen Gyllenhaal. Jake's mom was Naomi Foner, a respected screenplay writer. That meant he'd grown up in Hollywood where nepotism in films was rife. Was Jake really up to playing the lead role in a movie? I didn't know, but we were all about to find out. Chapter 6. The next time Linda and I returned to the shoot, the scene was when my first rocket exploded and blew up the fence around our yard. Rather than the heavy wood and wire fence we actually blew up, a white picket fence, unknown in the real Colwood, was substituted at the Petros location. It was a complex scene in which three of the boys and the actress playing my mom interacted after the shattering explosion. Earlier, I had asked Joe for permission to video everything, and he graciously agreed. As soon as I was led to a place in front of the Hickam house, my little camera started purring. Stuntmen, substituting for the boys, climbed into their harnesses for the scene. Attached to them was a spring mechanism to jerk them back just as the rocket exploded. The way the fence was situated, the mine tipple and shops could be seen in the background. That meant miners and townspeople needed to be seen walking back and forth, and it was fascinating to see how all that was organized. The assistant director yelled, "Background!" and the extras started walking. Joe waited a beat, then said action, and the fuse to the rocket was lit and the stuntmen prepared themselves. When the rocket exploded in a mighty blast, the spring was sprung, causing the boys to be jerked backward. After Joe checked the result in the video that ran synchronously with the film camera, he pronounced himself satisfied with just one take. That meant several of the rocket props were left over. Mine is presently residing in Seattle's Museum of Flight. While Joe and the tech crew conferred over the next scene, I watched Jack, Will, and Chad clown around with some impromptu dance steps. I took that as a good sign, since their chemistry was key to making them believable as childhood friends. But Joe didn't much like it and sent an assistant director over to tell them to settle down. Natalie Cannaday walked over to say hello to Linda and me. Dressed in her 1950s housewife dress, she confided she was in so many scenes it was going to keep her on location probably from the first day to the last, whenever that was. It had rained steadily during the past week, and that had caused several days of shooting to be lost. I steered the conversation to my mom, the real Elsie Hickam, and by providing a few anecdotes told Natalie what a strong woman she was. She thought about that and said, "Then I'll play her strong." The scene that followed took several takes. Jake and the other boys replaced the stuntmen and sprawled in the yard as if they'd just been blown up. When Joe's call for action came, a prop man threw pieces of the fence on them, and the boys shook their heads and rubbed their ears. Natalie flung open the screen door and came running onto the porch, there to see the carnage of her fence and the boys on their backs. "What happened?" she yelled, with Jake responding, "Our rocket blew up!" After a few more innocuous lines, Natalie suddenly turned on her heel and yelled, "It's all right, Mrs. Beale," at a neighbor woman, in a voice that sounded like a wood chipper eating a steel bar. At the outburst, Joe's head snapped up, and I thought he was going to tell her to do the line softer, but then he shrugged, which pleased me. Because of our little talk, Natalie had played Elsie strong, and Joe was going to keep it that way. Linda had asked Joe for permission to take photographs on the sets, and he'd agreed, as long as Chuck didn't mind. Linda asked Chuck, and he'd said there was no problem. For the most part, I kept my distance from Chuck because I knew how busy and distracted he was, and maybe I was a bit intimidated by him, too. In contrast, he and Linda were fast friends. Both were physical fitness and diet nuts, so they had a lot to talk about, including teasing each other. I wasn't jealous. Not much, anyway. Between takes, I strolled over to talk to the special effects folks. Joey DiGaetano, affectionately called Joey D, headed up the team. His two vans held a complete machine shop, stacks of steel and aluminum bar stock and cylinders, various chemicals, and a group of talented and skilled men and women who loved to fly rockets and blow things up. Just my kind of people. Although I didn't notice it at the time, Joey D looked a lot like a young Wernher von Braun, but Joe had noticed the similarity very well. Toward the end of the movie, Joey D would show up and shake the hand of Jake after the win at the National Science Fair. I didn't know the scene existed until after I'd seen the first edit. Joe's response when I thanked him, "I wanted you to finally meet Wernher von Braun." One aside, to play the part, Joey D had to dye his normally light brown hair to nearly black. His fiancée was not happy about that since it hadn't grown out in time for their wedding. Joey D and I talked over the rockets he was building. Usually he said rockets in movies were wire-guided, but Joe wanted more realistic flights. He showed me how he'd scraped away at the motors to change thrust vectors that would make the rockets flip and turn on cue. It was a slick solution, and I was impressed by his ingenuity. When the time came to launch the first rocket of the movie, he asked me to push the button. Naturally, I agreed. The next day, we were back at the slack dump for a scene that included our beloved teacher, Miss Riley, played by Laura Dern of Jurassic Park fame. Every so often during the filming, it would occur to me that I was watching a major motion picture being made about a portion of my life, and it would suddenly feel very surreal. Seeing Laura Dern step outside her trailer caused one of those moments. Because of something I'd written, this well-known actress had traveled all the way from Hollywood to East Tennessee. Incredible! Everyone on the crew craned their necks to see Laura, and before long, A runner sought me out to tell me she wanted a word. Excited, I hoofed my way over to where she was standing beside an old car for the shot. After a quick introduction, she said, "I love Miss Riley. I didn't get a chance to read all of your book, but I read the parts about her." This was a nice surprise. I'd given Joe enough manuscripts of my final draft to send to all the main actors, but didn't think he'd actually done it. Laura turned her dazzling smile on me like a 1,000-watt bulb. "I'd like to talk to you more about her when you've got some time." Well, what's a Colwood boy to do? I kicked the dirt, grinned, and said, "Ma'am, just let me know when." After Laura did her scenes, it was time to launch a rocket. Joey D. handed me the igniter, and I waited for the signal from the assistant director. After a short countdown, I pressed the button, and the rocket whooshed off the pad and headed for the sky atop a thin white smoke trail. Afterwards, more rockets were launched, some of them designed to be acrobats. One of them did a somersault, another ricocheted off the coal, another jumped a few feet, then exploded. Joe was ecstatic and came over to tell Joey D. how much he appreciated what he and his crew had created. I added my enthusiastic praise. With a lot of time on our hands while Joe and his camera operators and gaffers and best boys and such did all the work, Linda and I made friends with the drivers, who, once they'd driven everybody where they needed to go, mostly stood around. Since they were all Teamster Union members and I was a former member of the United Mine Workers and still just a Colwood boy at heart, we got along great. They kept sneaking me fruit jars full of Tennessee moonshine, which I had no intention of drinking. I'd gotten truly sick on it when I was a teenaged rocket boy. To get pure alcohol for our rockets, John I., the bootlegger in Colwood, insisted the real rocket boys drink a little of it. The result was I had never been so sick in my life. I wrote it this way in Rocket Boys. Roy Lee held his glass up for a toast. "To Werner von Braun." Odell followed suit and wiped his mouth, tears streaming down his cheeks. "Good." It came out a strained whisper. Everyone looked at me. It was for Werner von Braun, after all. I tossed back the drink, not even letting the liquid roll across my tongue. It went straight back to my gullet and caught on fire. I nearly doubled over as I felt it burn all the way to my stomach. I tried to breathe, but nothing worked. Roy Lee pounded on my back. "How about that, old son? Is that rocket fuel or what?" Tom Spain thought the moonshine scene in the book was all-round wonderful, and I did too, but unfortunately it was reduced in the screenplay to a brief scene that only lasted a few seconds. I talked to Joe about expanding it, but he shook his head. "I'm going to have trouble editing this movie down as it is," he explained over his shoulder as he walked away. I didn't pursue him. Whenever Linda and I were spotted, crew members came rushing over to make sure we were comfortable with a good view of the action. The Teamsters all fell in love with Linda and kept coming by with gifts for her, mostly candy and cookies they'd taken from the Tomcat Craft Services trailer. Her pockets were always stuffed with goodies. Joe had his hand in everything. In one instance, we found a fellow spreading autumnal leaves around, and it turned out he'd painted each leaf to match the colors Joe had specified. In the company store set, every tin can label was authentic, down to the right color for the Underwood deviled ham. At the high school set, we discovered each drawer in the library had the correct Dewey Decimal System labels on them, even though the camera only briefly panned through the scene. We also found a woman scorching and cutting a healthy plant that was destined to sit in the corner of the principal's office because Joe thought Mr. Turner probably wouldn't water it too often. We were shown the swatches of fabric and paint chips Joe had provided to the technicians to make sure everything blended in. The fellow who brought in the vintage cars confided that Joe had specified no bright cars. On set, Joe inspected the hair coloring of both the stars and the extras to make sure they fit his vision. He was also using smoke pots to give Colwood a dark, misty atmosphere to match Tennessee's gray skies. This turned the movie darker than I think he originally planned, but would pay off as Colwood became an ominous place on screen. The audience could understand just by its palette that it was a place to leave behind. When it started to snow, Joe kept filming, even though, for continuity's sake, Jake and the boys wore light clothing. To stay warm in between takes, they gathered around heat blowers and sucked down coffee and hot chocolate until the time Joe ordered them back out on the slack. Shivering, Naomi stood beside me, her voice raspy. "I just hope Jake doesn't get sick," she said. "He seems like a tough kid," I replied. "Until this movie, I didn't know how tough," she said, and went on to explain how much she and his father wanted him to go to college rather than become an actor. "It's opposite the way it was with you and your dad," she added. "You wanted to go to college, but he wanted you to stay in the family business." "Well," I replied, "it's hard to tell your dad you want to do something with your life that's different from what he wants." "That's what this story is really about," Naomi said. "It's about you and your dad." It shouldn't have surprised me that Naomi got it. A writer herself, she had stripped the layers of the rockets and the coal mining away from the story and gotten down to its core. Rocket Boys was ultimately a father-son story. Field of Dreams, of course, was also a father-son story, and I wondered if this was why Chuck wanted to make the movie. When I next talked to Mickey, I asked him about that. "I guess we've all got issues with our old man," he replied, "Chuck included." Mickey, of course, was right. Our fathers had come out of the Depression and World War II, a generation not known for hugs or compliments. They provided their children with food on the table and roofs over their heads. We baby boomers had issues with our fathers growing up, only to realize what great men they were when we looked back. When Joe came over to say hello between shots, I mentioned that Laura Dern wanted to talk to me about Miss Riley. He shrugged and said he thought it was always good for actors to talk. I didn't know exactly what he meant by that, but I took it to mean he had no objection. Before long, Laura sent word for me to visit her in her trailer where she was having her hair styled for the next scene. When I entered, she nodded toward a chair. "How do you think the filming is going?" she asked. "I'm not an expert," I replied, "but it seems to be going fine. I know everybody was excited about you coming." "It was a role that interested me," she answered while the stylist worked her hair into large rollers. "I could see layers of emotion in the character. Tell me more about her." This was easy enough, so I told her about Miss Riley and how tough, disciplined, and determined she was to see her Rocket Boy succeed. "Not much of that is in the script," she pointed out. This was undeniably true. Miss Riley's part was rather thin. Laura said, "I don't think that's fair to her memory." A runner stuck his head inside the trailer to tell Laura she was due on set. "Tell them I'll be there in a few minutes." The runner glanced at me, then hurried out. We kept talking about Miss Riley. 10 minutes later, the runner returned. "They say they need you now." Laura calmly waited for the hairdresser to finish while I took my leave and slipped out of the trailer where I found Joe and Larry looking at me. A few days later, once we'd moved inside an old school in Knoxville to film interiors of Big Creek High, Larry asked me to meet him in Chuck's trailer. As soon as I sat down, his expression informed me he was about to deliver some unhappy news. "Laura's trying to rewrite her part," he said. "All she says is, 'Well, Homer said this and Homer said that. We don't want you to talk to her again.'" "Joe said it was okay," I replied, as lamely as I felt. "Talking's one thing, but this is something else. You've been trying to rewrite this script from the start, and we don't appreciate it." I opened my mouth to argue, but then clapped it shut. Larry was absolutely correct, and it made no sense to deny it. I had wanted the screenplay to be closer to my book, and to the extent I could, I had used a variety of tactics to make that happen. As for Laura, I knew very well she wanted to see Miss Riley's part expanded, and I had helped her simply by talking to her. Considering the weather and the budget, things weren't going well, and I had added to the problems of the movie. My response was to offer to leave and not come back. At this, Larry backpedaled, assuring me that he and Chuck and Joe loved having me and Linda on set. "We just need your help," he said. "You have it," I replied, and the meeting was over. Inside the school, Chris Ellis, the actor playing Principal Turner, came up for a word. I was glad for Chris's presence on the set. It seemed when he was there, everything went smoothly, due to his competency and fine portrayal of the irascible Mr. Turner. Then Linda came to tell me Iva Dean, Miss Riley's sister, had arrived. Iva was also a teacher and was thrilled that her sister was being portrayed in the movie. After we chatted for a while, Laura walked over and listened attentively while Iva spoke lovingly about her older sister. "I will do my best to bring Frida to the screen," Laura vowed. "Homer and I have been talking about how strong she was, and I'm working to get more of that in the script." With Laura still on the hunt to make her part bigger and better, I thought it best to stay out of sight for the rest of the day. My editor, Tom Spain, was visiting, so we found a quiet corner and talked about the book. After watching some scenes filmed, he said he had his doubts about the movie, but not to worry. The book was going to get a big rollout. He showed me a long list of bookstores I would be visiting on the book tour, plus television and radio shows that had already voiced an interest in having me on. Since there had been no book tour for Torpedo Junction, I had no clue about the amount of work the tour would ultimately require. After Tom left, I went back into the school to watch whatever scene was next, and inadvertently ran afoul of the movie makers again. The scene had Homer and Quentin in a science lab, mixing potentially explosive chemicals that might be good for rocket propellant. When the teacher spots them, they hurriedly wash their rocket fuel down a sink. A moment later, a student lights a Bunsen burner and tosses the match into her sink, which turns all the sinks into flamethrowers. It was a cute scene, but it took a number of times before Joe was satisfied. Getting more and more frustrated, he kept calling for another shot. Finally, he shook his head and called for lunch. In the Tomcat lunchroom, I got a tray and found a seat. Joe came in and sat across from me, and without a word began to eat. Offhandedly, I offered a remark about the scene he'd just shot. "You do realize, Joe," I said, "that the chemicals the boys were mixing couldn't possibly ignite when wet, don't you?" Joe slowly lowered his fork, looked me in the eye, and said, "You do realize, Homer, we're only trying to sell popcorn here, don't you?" The rest of the meal was eaten in silence. On the drive back to our Oak Ridge hotel, I told Linda what Joe had said. Her reply was concise. "Homer, you really need to just shut up." Of course, she was exactly right. Still, I pointed out that Joe and Larry and Chuck would go on to make other movies, even if Rocket Boys was a colossal flop, but I would have to live with it for the rest of my life. I had a right to make suggestions, didn't I? Linda feigned sleep while I mulled everything over. What was right or wrong was not clear. The answer was gray, like the gloomy clouds that seemed to have permanently settled over East Tennessee and the people struggling to make a little movie about boys and rockets. Chapter 7. It was when we were the most miserable that I realized something remarkable was happening. This epiphany occurred during the filming of the coal mine disaster, the accident that killed Ike Bykovsky, the machinist whom my father banished underground after he'd helped us build our rockets. The marvelous Elia Baskin played Ike in the movie and did a terrific job with the part. The accident that killed Ike caused Dad to suffer an awful head wound and the near loss of an eye. In the book, as in the movie, the event occurs at night, and when the injured men are brought up, it's during a lightning storm and a driving rain. The scene at the mine was one Joe and set designer Barry Robison tried to make as realistic as possible. A sprinkler system was brought in to simulate the rain, and strobe lights were positioned to simulate lightning. That night, I was joined by Odell Carroll, one of the real Rocket Boys. Earlier in the day, Odell had met Chad, who was playing him, and they had enjoyed talking about what it was like in Coalwood 40 years ago. Now, in the cold dampness, and after so much excitement, Odell was unwell. "I need a place to lie down," he said. Worried, I asked him if I could take him back to his hotel, or if he needed it, to the hospital. Odell assured me he just needed to go somewhere warm. I suggested the machine shop set, located in a small building nearby, and led him to it, made certain he was comfortable, and then came back to the tipple set. Linda and I found a place in the shadows to watch the filming unfold. The extras playing townspeople, most of them carrying black umbrellas, closed in around sawhorses set up as a barrier and waited patiently to be told what to do. Joe, dressed in a yellow rain slicker, emerged from the bank of cameras and technicians, touched one of the sawhorses, then kicked it over. When Barry came running, Joe began to yell at him because the paint on the sawhorses wasn't dry. Everyone watched in shocked silence until Barry walked away with his head down. Joe, his shoulders hunched, kicked over another sawhorse, then returned to the cameras and his open-mouthed crew. The next thing I knew, Barry was standing beside me. He was agitated, but he said, "Sorry you had to see that. I should have painted the sawhorses earlier, but there's been so much to do to get ready for this shot." He took a breath, then allowed a long sigh to help him get hold of his nerves. "Joe wants it to be perfect," he said, "because he knows you're watching." The astonishment registering on my face would have been a close-up moment had the cameras been pointing at me instead of Jake Gyllenhaal. Joe wanted the scene perfect for me? I had no idea he cared what I thought, one way or the other. Barry walked off into the frosty night, leaving me to contemplate his words. The temperature kept plunging until it hovered around freezing. A technician came by and said Joe was going to test the sprinklers with warm water so the actors would be more comfortable when they got wet. The result of the test, however, was a vapor cloud that cloaked the set. Joe ordered the next test with cold water, and this time the air stayed clear. Joe called, "Action!" And the rain machine started, and Jake came out of the crowd of extras and said his lines as the townspeople reacted. After several takes, Jake's lips were blue. When he spotted me, he rushed over. "What were you feeling that night?" he asked through chattering teeth. "Confusion, misery, and denial," I answered. Jake blinked thoughtfully, then said, "Thanks," and went back to work. Joe kept calling for take after take, and Jake kept persevering through them. Chris Cooper, the award-winning actor newly arrived on location to play my dad, stumbled with a bandage around his head through the crowd to a waiting ambulance. The townspeople turned away and fled the now abandoned tipple, while Jake slogged through the mud to the tag board where Mr. Bykovsky's mind tag was hung, evidence that he would never be back to reclaim it. Jake had no lines, but anyone seeing the movie knows by his expression and body language that he's cold and miserable and sad and in disbelief. It was not entirely acting, since he was all those things after hours of being soaked by the sprinklers in the freezing, windy night. Still, I think it was the moment the movie began to belong to Jake. It was midnight before the scene was done to Joe's satisfaction. By then, the actors and crew were nearly frozen, but nobody complained. Odell came up to me. He'd warmed up in the machine shop and had watched the last couple of takes. "I have to pinch myself every so often that this is really happening," he said. "Me too, Odell," I said with a sigh. "Me too." The cameramen took down their equipment, and the rain truck trundled away. The extras crowded inside the machine shop to get warm and have some coffee and hot chocolate. Joe slowly took off his rain cap, briefly looked my way, and then caught sight of Barry. He gestured for him to come over, and they shook hands. When I saw him later, Barry said, "When you work on a movie where the director is just having fun, everything is pretty smooth. But Joe really cares about this movie, and so does the crew. They'll do whatever it takes to make this film the best they can, because the story they're telling is so rare. But I don't have to tell you that." Actually, he did. For me, the tale of the Colwood Rocket Boys wasn't rare at all. It had been my life, after all, but for everybody else, the tale was about a unique moment in time in a place that no longer existed. It was good to be reminded of that. I allowed myself a brief moment of pride in what I had started, then reminded myself of something the people of Colwood taught me. When good things happen, it's usually because lots of good folks are working hard to make it that way. A lot of good folks were helping to make this movie the best they could every way they could. And it wasn't because they were interested in selling popcorn either. I knew that, and I was certain Joe Johnston did too. Chapter 8. After the accident scene, the making of the movie shifted into high gear. The days started early, most of the cast and crew rolling out at 4 a.m. to journey to whatever location was on the daily call sheet. Most were lucky to get to bed before midnight. A note on the extras who came out every day to be in the movie. Never in the history of movie making has there been a better, more dedicated group of people. They had fallen in love with not only the idea of being in a movie, but the movie itself. Many of them were former coal miners, and they dressed up in the mining garb like the seasoned professionals they were. They loved carrying the old-style cylindrical lunch buckets, although the prop guys had to fill them with rocks so they wouldn't swing them too high. The extras, playing townspeople, flocked to the trailers to get their costumes, makeup, and 1950s hairstyles. Their grins were huge, and I signed lots of autographs. Larry Franco worked with the extras on several scenes. At the beginning of the movie, a veteran miner holds a radio to his ear, listening to news of Sputnik as he descends into the mine. The gentleman, however, kept cutting his eyes toward the camera. Joe was on the verge of replacing him when Larry took the man aside and told him if he looked at the camera again, he was going to feel the effect of a shovel in the side of his head. The extra/miner got it perfectly right on the next take. Similarly, Larry threatened the extras with various mythical tortures if they didn't keep their eyes on the invisible rocket climbing into the sky in the last scene in the movie. The group mostly complied. One of the best days during the filming was out in the Tennessee countryside in early March, when the sun reappeared and the Norfolk and Western Railroad came to life again. All during my childhood, N&W trains rolled through the coal fields to haul our black diamonds to the outside world. To this day, the sound of a train whistle in the night takes me right back to Coalwood, and the chuffing locomotives and clack of steel wheels rolling on the rails. We soon learned Joe Johnston was a train buff. He lobbied long and hard with Chuck, who in turn lobbied Universal Studios to bring in a steam locomotive and a line of coal cars. His excuse was because he wanted to faithfully recreate the scene where the boys are pulling up spikes and rails on a defunct section of track in order to make money to build their rockets. As I wrote in the book, the truth was we were going after the cast iron pipe beneath the tracks, but never mind. The Tennessee Film Commission jumped in to help, and the Tennessee Valley Railway Museum in Chattanooga agreed to send a 1950s-era Southern Railway steam locomotive, old 4501, with several coal cars all dressed out in Norfolk and Western livery. The real Roy Lee Cook turned up to see the train scene. It was great to see Roy Lee teamed up with Will Lee Scott, the actor playing him. Both of them were good at telling funny and often dirty stories, and they soon had the crew laughing. After seeing Roy Lee and his wife Betty settled into director's chairs to watch the action, I moved in closer with my little video camera. By then, with Joe's permission, I was videotaping nearly everything. The setup was two scenes. In the first one, the boys are shown stealing the track from an abandoned rail spur. In the second, after hearing a train whistle, they run to stop it from running off the rails. The punchline was it isn't going down the spur at all, but past a switch on the main line. The first scene went well, but the second required Jake and the other boys to run down the track. When Joe asked for them to practice the run, I noticed Jake had an awkward gait. During a pause to wait for a stubborn cloud to move, I called him over and asked him if he wanted to run like a West Virginia boy. When he nodded, albeit uncertainly, I demonstrated by running a short distance away and then back again. "You see how I hold my arms? Tuck your elbows in and pump your arms with closed fists. That's how a West Virginia boy runs." Jake tried it a couple of times, then said, "I can do that," and did in the next takes. These days I notice Jake is a runner. I like to think I showed him how. As for Joe, he was nearly giddy when 4501 chuffed onto the scene. I asked if I could go aboard and was given permission. Following me, with considerable help by a couple of stout men in the crew, was an elderly, slightly befuddled-looking gentleman. He was greeted warmly by the engineer and fireman, then allowed to settle into the engineer's seat. Joe was right behind him, and I learned that the man was none other than O. Winston Link, the famous photographer whose series on steam locomotives had made him an icon in the world of train aficionados. I also learned Link was in the second stage of Alzheimer's disease, but on that day, it didn't matter. Joe was letting him fulfill a dream, to actually operate one of the locomotives he had so lovingly photographed, including those hauling vast lines of coal cars through the West Virginia coalfields of my youth. Joe hopped off to supervise the camera setup, but I stayed on board. For the rest of the day, we ran up and down the track. Link's job was to wave at the cameras as we ground by while also pulling the whistle chain. When that proved too difficult, the engineer, who was actually operating the train from the floor, decided that he would also reach up and pull the whistle. When Link kept missing his wave, I said, "Tell you what, Mr. Link, how about I pull your pants leg when you're supposed to wave? Would that be okay?" Link nodded, and I lay down on the cab deck where I could just glimpse the cameras as they came into view. When they did, I tugged Link's pants leg and he waved. When we stopped, Joe hopped aboard.
"That was perfect." He glanced at me. "You still here, Homer?"
I shrugged and said nothing about the part I'd played. We next returned to the Wartburg slack dump, this time to burn the blockhouse. In the book, the wood shack with a tin roof was torn down by bullies, but burning it was more cinematic. Joey D. and his folks moved a special blockhouse soaked in kerosene into position, and then gave Jake and the other boys their instructions. To set it ablaze required Jake to toss a Molotov cocktail into the blockhouse from 30 feet away. The cocktail was a whiskey bottle filled with kerosene and a rag for a fuse, so it wasn't like throwing a baseball. Joe came out from behind the cameras and had a talk with Jake about how to throw the bottle. I could tell he was worried. His star was about to handle a bottle of kerosene that was on fire. Everyone held their breath when Will lit the bottle in Jake's hand and backed off. Jake didn't have